Good afternoon. I'm Cass Harrington, and you're listening to The Trend on WNIN-FM. Today, we're talking about domestic violence. In 2011, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention published a study that found a staggering number. More than one in three women and more than one in four men in the United States have experienced rape, physical violence, and/or stalking by an intimate partner in their lifetime. So victims of domestic abuse are from all races, ethnicities, and sexual identities. Today, we're taking a closer look at the issue here in the tri-state and what can be done to minimize that startling figure. To open up the conversation, I spoke with a woman who was in an abusive marriage, and she opened up her experience in a book called Living in the Black. Her story has been adapted into a musical, which debuts at the Henderson Fine Arts Center on Saturday. Living in the Black, the title, here's an obvious question. How does it relate to the story that we're going to be talking about today?
So the title was actually created by Alyssa Curie, my co-author, and she also did the editing and the book cover. So I had a different name. I think it was called Lipstick Alley, and it was about, you know, my hiding secrets in a little box. And she changed it to Living in the Black, which is very relevant because I was also hiding black eyes. Because during my marriage, there was domestic violence, and there were incidents where I was grabbed or even hit, and I would have a black eye and I would hide it. So it's very relevant to call the story Living in the Black, because many women brush it under the rug. They're embarrassed when it happens, and it is. It's very shameful and it's embarrassing, and we don't want to talk about it. So when we don't recognize that it's happening, which I didn't for a long time, I was living in the black.
And here you are, I must say, bravely coming forward and bringing your story to light. Why? Why now?
You know, I watched my daughter growing up. She's now 21. I knew that I needed to talk to her very candidly about the topic and be real honest with her. And if I couldn't be honest with what happened in my own household, you know, how could I teach her? So that was my driving force. And also writing the book and telling my story helped me to heal. And it is also a platform to inspire other women to tell their story. Because if we don't bring the conversation forward, we allow the cycle to continue. And I'm taking the leadership role. I'm telling my story, and I want others to come forward and tell theirs.
So the story is largely reflective of your experience. It's about a young woman, also named Brenda, who has a successful career, a husband, and a newborn baby, and then her husband became abusive. But in the story, you have signs kind of scattered throughout the beginning. Can you illustrate that to our listeners? What sorts of perhaps early signs that maybe someone might ignore or maybe not even recognize in the beginning?
Yes. One of the signs is controlling behavior. And I think when you're in love and you meet someone and they're very attentive, they ask questions, where are you going? What time are you going to come back, etc. You don't think of it as controlling, but it's a subtle sign. It's something that you should question. Another sign is someone with a temper, someone who reacts versus just, you know, in a calm manner, ask a question. So reactions that are, I'm not going to say aggressive, but more than subtle. That's a sign.
Just drastic for a situation.
Jealousy. And then, you know, I had some warnings from other people, you know, he has a temper, or, well, you know, there was a situation, I can't really say anything, but I brushed it away because this was my marriage, this was my love. And again, domestic violence is overshadowed by love, because you don't want to be alone and you want to be with that person and you love them. But I learned through my experience, love is not supposed to be painful. Mm-hmm. And so it took me a while, but I had to redefine love. I had to really reassess how I was defining love. And women, unfortunately, will stay in a relationship because they think no one else will love me, or, well, he tells me he loves me all the time, and, you know, I'm committed to this relationship, and I'm really in love, and I know it happened once, and he said it wouldn't happen again.
Or maybe I can change him.
Yeah, there you go, but you have to stop. You have to stop. You have to admit it. Okay, these things are happening. It's not right, and you need to take the next step. You know, call your pastor, or go to a center. You know, Albion Fellows Bacon Center here has great resources. YWCA has great resources. So you have to admit it. That's the first step. If you don't admit it, then you're accepting it. And I accepted it for years and just kept it to myself.
When your husband physically abused you for the first time, what went through your head? How could you rationalize that? I know we just talked about more subtle things like aggressive or controlling behavior, but with physical abuse, how does a brain process that? I know there are so many different components.
The first time actually happened while we were engaged. I was in total disbelief. I was in shock. Because here I was, a 30-year-old professional, had it all together, and had met the love of my life, and there was an incident where he grabbed me here and
by
around
the
my
neck.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I was, how my brain processed it, I was very fearful. I was very shocked. And I just couldn't believe it happened to me. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't something that I wanted to call home and tell my mom about. I thought, well, what did I do, you know? And once things settled down, we talked about it. And, you know, I heard everything from, I'm sorry, I love you, it'll never happen again, I don't know what came over me. It went on and on. So there you have it. There was the first sign, and I ignored it. Mm-hmm. And we got married. We did get married. And so I think the brain goes into shock first. And then I think you try to reason. And once you reason, then that's your story. That's your way of putting it behind your back or putting it under the rug. Because mm-hmm. I've justified it. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's not wrong because we talked about it. I've justified it. And so that's what we can't do. And I made that mistake. So when you read the book and when you see the play, Living in the Black, you'll know not to do that. And that's the whole purpose of telling my story.
We're going to talk about more about the book and the play in a little bit. But I do have one more question. You know, you talked about things that women should do, especially victims, and signs they should look for, and immediately, you know, trying not to deny a situation. But, you know, from what sociologists and many researchers know about men and abusive behavior, is it's often a cyclical pattern where it came from something they'd seen in their fathers or in their own environment growing up. And I'm wondering if that connection was there with your ex-husband, or even if there are some things that we should do more as an early intervention with young men.
You know what? It wasn't recognized by my husband. You know, I even talked to a family member on my ex-husband's side, and the conversation came up about what was happening. I didn't go into detail, but abuse came up. And the reaction and the response that I got is, you guys should really work it out. So I don't know to this day if he saw it. I'm sure he did, but it was never revealed to me by him. Mm-hmm. It was something that he maybe brushed under the rug. As far as society today, you know, we have the internet, we have Twitter, we have all these technologies. Here's what I think. There's a lot of focus on the victim. If someone's abused, like a Rihanna or someone famous, Ray Rice's wife, you know, there's a hashtag, you know, why I stayed. But there isn't a hashtag for the abuser, why I abused. And if we had a hashtag for the abuser, I think they would feel more comfortable talking about why is this a cycle, or I saw my mom, you know, be abused by my dad, so it's something that I think is normal. So we need to give more attention to why he abuses. Let's understand why that happens, then we can maybe work to resolve it. So hashtag abusers as much as you do victims.
Then it would raise, I think, a fear of probably a lot of just, I guess, just an angry reaction toward the abuser if it sounded like an excuse, hashtag why I abused.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be an excuse. It could be their story. You know, here's the deal. Vice President Joe Biden recently referred to domestic violence as a public health epidemic. You know, it's the leading cause of injury to women. So it is something, you know, we have to bring the conversation forward, and we can't keep brushing the abusers under the rug. We don't have to be angry and, you know, treat them disrespectfully, but we have to come to the table with a real conversation and figure out what can we do to change.
Well, that's why you're here. And so I understand you brought a copy of the book to share with our listeners. And I was hoping maybe you could read a passage that could help illustrate for our listeners a situation that may not be so obvious.
Yeah, so one of the scenes in the book and in the play deals with Cedric, one of the characters. His name is Cedric, and he is getting married, and Cedric's sister-in-law, her name is Terry, is helping with, you know, putting the gifts away at the wedding and celebrating. And part of the celebration is stealing the bride. And so Cedric really flares up when he finds that his wife is gone. And this is how the scene reads. Terry and Cedric finish placing the wedding gifts in the trunk of the car. Christian jumped in the driver's seat and was ready for what was to happen next. The chart house wasn't empty yet because many of the guests still lingered to nibble on wedding cake and what was left of the buffet. Terry noticed that Cedric had been pacing the floor in the main hallway leading to the piano room. "What's wrong, Cedric? Did you lose something?" Cedric looked uncomfortable and began to loosen his bow tie. "Yeah, my wife," he snapped. Terry smiled at him. "She's not lost, trust me. I can't really say anything, but I want to surprise you. Come with me." Cedric began pacing the floor and said, "I'm not going anywhere until I find Brenda. Brenda, Brenda, babe, where are you?" he yelled. "Cedric, please don't yell. Your guests are still here. And there's no need to yell." Brenda stepped out. "She's not here. It's part of the surprise." "Surprise? I don't want a surprise. What in the hell happened to my wife? Where is she? Brenda!" Cedric began walking through the chart house, searching and shouting. "Shh, Cedric, let's go. I'll take you to her. Please calm down. Let's go," Terry said.
So that possessive, controlling behavior that you talked about in the beginning really kind of illustrated there.
Yeah.
Is that scene part of your personal story?
It is. It is. And it happened. You know, the wedding was beautiful. I wasn't actually present at the time. My sister told me the story, and that's the character, Terry. And she told me the story like, "You're not going to believe, you know, what happened to, you know, Cedric here." I mean, he kind of went off, and wow, I couldn't believe that behavior. That was her reaction to me.
How did you feel? Were you
embarrassed?
You know
what? I didn't think anything of it because I knew him well. And I just thought, oh, temper tantrum, no big deal. Maybe had a little champagne, he's like that. The problem with domestic violence is, first of all, it's a cowardly way to react to something that doesn't go your way. I mean, it just, come on, okay? But the bigger issue is, by the time it happens, a pattern has built. So you know what's going on, and you've actually come up with, a strategy on how to calm him down or what have you. So the pattern's built. And then before that, there have been signs, but they were ignored. So we allow the pattern to be built. So my mission and my outreach to others is to recognize the signs early and take note. Don't let a pattern build. Because when you let a pattern build, then you're accepting it. And if someone is an abuser, well, I mean, you didn't say anything the first time, or
it's like
we've come to an agreement that, okay, this is how we're going to work things out. And that pattern's built and both people recognize it. Mm-hmm. But if you don't allow this to happen by making a decision when the first signs appear, then you can hopefully avoid the cycle and avoid the pattern.
Well, now this story has been adapted for the stage, and it will be playing this weekend in Henderson. And I understand that you've been able to attend a couple of rehearsals. There is, I understand also, there's a beatdown scene. What was it like to see it, acted out with real human beings in front of you?
Well, you know what? I didn't actually see the scene. I saw portions of it. I didn't actually see the beatdown scene, but the questions that the cast members asked me just made my heart palpitate, because I remember clearly what happened to me, and my reaction was, oh Lord, they're actually going to do this. And it was emotional. You know, it's great to see the story take place on stage, and I think Stanley Jackson has picked some awesome scenes from the book, but it's real.
Let's have a listen to that.
I don't know where she is. 3 o'clock in the morning. She out here 7 months pregnant. Where the heck have you been?
Cedric, I've been looking all over for you. You left this house at 11 o'clock. It's 3 in the morning. And have you been drinking?
Yeah, I've been drinking. I'm a grown man. You ain't got to go out and look for me nowhere. I'm a grown man. I can drink when I want to. I can go where I want to. It don't take you to go around to the places that I go to and ask my friends where I've been at.
Cedric,
always nagging me.
That's not what I meant by that.
Oh, yeah, that's what you meant. Because that's what you did. If you didn't mean it, you wouldn't do it. You know what? I'm just getting so tired of you doing this. Every time I turn around, you just want to keep doing it. You want to keep nagging me. You want to keep following them around. You know what?
So there's a beatdown scene in the play. I mean, what do you think will happen when people come to see this? I mean, you're going to have all different kinds of people. People who perhaps likely, I mean, it's common, who have experienced domestic abuse in their life, whether personally or seeing a friend or a sister go through it. You're also going to, I mean, there will be men in the audience. Do you have different hopes for the takeaway of maybe an outcome?
You know, my hope for the outcome is that we no longer accept it. It will be, parts of the play will be emotional, and parts of the play will be joyous. But my hope for the outcome is that everyone, men, women, mothers, teenagers, begin to take the steps necessary to break down this cycle and stop the cycle from continuing. I had a young lady tell me that she was abused by her husband, and she got out of the relationship, and she said she knew something was wrong when her husband grabbed her mother. And I listened to her, and then she said, well, her mom and dad were violent toward each other. There was domestic abuse when she was growing up, and so she saw it. And the cycle has to end. And if we don't grab onto it now, our children will think it's okay because you demonstrated that it was okay.
Mm-hmm.
And their children will think it's okay because if they don't change and it happens to them, they'll see it. So I really hope when people leave the Henderson Fine Arts Center that it's a discussion at dinner after the play or the next day, Sunday morning, or in church. It has to be discussed.
So my first question, why you wrote this? You said you were concerned about your daughter. You wanted to have this conversation with her. So now this book is published. The play is going to be in Henderson this weekend. I assume you've had that conversation with your daughter. And do you think, she's going to be resilient and strong in her relationships in the future? Or?
Oh, absolutely. She already is. And she's an amazing young woman. She's a Christian. She puts God first. She is a leader, and actually soon to be engaged.
Hmm.
Yeah, they're working on that. So yeah, and it's something. Domestic violence is, there were remnants of it when I was growing up, but my mom never talked about it. And so I thought through that, and there's sections of that story in the book. And you can't brush it under the rug and expect, your children, not to to understand it. You never want anybody to accept domestic violence. And the conversation, it should start with the grandmothers. I mean, there mm-hmm. was a time when it was okay to do that, even though it never really should have been, but you kept your dirty laundry in the closet or whatever the phrase you want to use. But we just, society can no longer handle, the sexual assault, the domestic violence. I mean, we're ruining ourselves. We're ruining mm-hmm. our families by allowing the cycle to continue. So yes, I do. I'm very passionate about it, about helping others and doing what I can to break the cycle. And of course, I've done it with my daughter. And I think she's aware of the topic, and her friendships reflect that and just the kind of person she is. I don't think it will happen to her.
Hmm.
As a matter of fact, I know it won't.
It reminds me of the play Fences. I don't know if you've read it or seen it by August Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
The famous line, the sins of the fathers. And I think the character was Rose in the play. And she was hopeful that there was each new generation was an opportunity to break that cycle of violence. Now, of course, if they could escape and if their father was abusive, if they could, make the decision on their own or find some inspiration elsewhere. But yeah, each new generation is an opportunity to break that cycle of violence.
Is.
And it sounds like you're doing your part.
I'm doing my part.
Well, the play Living the Black will be showing this Saturday at the Henderson Fine Arts Center. And then what?
Well, so I have developed a nonprofit called the Brenda Blackman Project, and the purpose of the organization is to break the silence of domestic violence and create more awareness. And we're going to use non-traditional venues like the play everybody will see Saturday and panel discussions. We have a panel discussion Friday at the library, the Evansville Central Library. So the goal is to take this to Kansas City next, maybe Chicago next, and just keep the conversation going. I have applied for a grant, so I'm hoping that, I'm prayerful that that'll come through, and we'll bring it to Kansas next. And so the goal is to have this platform in as many cities as possible, because it's a very direct and fun way to bring that conversation forward.
Well, Brenda, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome, Cass. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
That was Brenda Blackman. Her story is acted out in the play Living in the Black, Saturday at the Henderson Fine Arts Center at 7 o'clock p.m. Central Time. We're going to take a quick break here on The Trend, and when we come back, we'll be joined by experts on domestic violence from the Albion Fellows Bacon Center and from the Vandenberg County Sheriff's Office. We're also taking your comments and questions on the air today. You can call the studio at 812-426-7400. Again, 812-426-7400, or send us a tweet at The Trend Talks.
Support comes from Children's Center for Dance Education, celebrating their 20th anniversary with a ballet performance of Sleeping Beauty on May 9th at 3 p.m. in the Old National Events Plaza. Ticket information at 812-421-8066 or childdance.org.
I got a secret that I can't share. All of this pain, it's gotta go somewhere. The people I know, they won't understand. All of this pain, like I can't.
This is The Trend on WNIN-FM. The number to call to make your comments or questions about domestic violence, 812-426-7400. 812-426-7400. Now we go back to the program.
Good afternoon. You're listening to The Trend today, the topic of conversation, domestic violence. And right off at the start of today's show, I mentioned a staggering statistic out there. One in three women and one in four men have experienced some form of domestic violence from their partner. And that number came from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And so I wanted to have two experts joining me in the studio to help me really take a second look at that number, because it's so huge, and see also what it looks like here locally. Joining me, I have Matthew Elrod. He is the detective of the domestic violence for the Vandenberg County Sheriff's Office. Matthew, thanks for joining us. Also, Leslie James, a crisis response advocate for Albion Fellows Bacon Center. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thanks.
So that number, one in three women, one in four men. Do you have a statistic or number that you use to frame this conversation? Because that to me just seems so enormous.
We do, yeah. The numbers that we use at Albion are pretty right on track with that. So we see some numbers from the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence and the Indiana Coalition Against Domestic Violence that suggest one in four women, one in seven men. We also see some statistics that tell us that domestic violence is a grossly underreported crime. We suspect that there's about a 50% report rate, so those numbers are closer to probably about two in four or half of all women, and maybe three in seven men who are affected by domestic violence in their lifetime.
Hmm. And Matthew?
Yeah, I think those numbers are pretty large. However, like she said, 50% are a report rate. I think a lot of crimes do go unreported. And like, 2013, we made 620 calls for domestic violence runs within the county. And then 2014, it was a higher rate of 690 calls. Both those numbers can be seen as a positive and negative. Positive being that, you know, more people are coming out, victims are speaking up and coming forward and reporting the crime. However, it can also be seen as negative, because in the same sentence, it looks like the crime rate is rising, but it's really hard to look at data and domestic violence and determine actually how many crimes are occurring, mm-hmm. because so many of them go unreported.
Sure, and I'm sure fear probably plays a big role in that underreporting.
Yeah, you know, a lot of times the victims, male or female, have that fear of retaliation. You know, they have the financial dependence, they have children in common. There's a lot of things that play a role in reporting a crime. A lot of times a victim doesn't, you know, want to see anything bad happen to the perpetrator. They feel like it's their fault. A lot of times, you know, for instance, they don't initially, they'll come forward, but you know, as time goes on, they want to veer away from getting the perpetrator in any kind of trouble. So that's, you know, that's kind of scary.
Well, I'm talking with Matthew Elrod, domestic violence detective for the Vandenberg County Sheriff's Office, and Leslie James, a crisis response advocate for the Albion Fellows Bacon Center. And we're also taking your calls and questions on the air. The number to call is 812-426-7400. And we do have a call from Deb in Evansville. Are you there?
Yeah. Okay. First off, I have been the victim of domestic violence, but I managed, because I understood what was going on, I managed to get out unscathed. And both men that were in my life were psychologically violent, going after the self-esteem, trying to isolate me, etc. And I also have just gone through a situation where my uncle was abused by his wife, her sister, and her mother. And part of his problem is that he suffered, he was diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder. And one of the things I noticed, because I've also done crisis intervention and I've worked on suicide hotlines too, one of the things I noticed that a lot of the victims and the perpetrators suffer from mental health issues, like obsessive compulsive, and they think that nobody will take them but this person, and they're willing to sacrifice their self-esteem. And I think now with, you know, health, you know, with healthcare companies now paying fairly, you know, really being forced to pay for mental health issues, that we will see some of this surface more. And I do agree.
Thank you for your comment, Deb. Do you have a question for our panelists?
I would just, you know, I would like to hear you guys talk about men going through it too, because okay, it's a real issue. Most people think only women, and men have a harder time with it.
All right, we will talk about that. Thank you for your call, Deb, and thank you for sharing your experience. Well, Leslie, Matthew, anything, men in particular, of course, we can't make the assumption that it's only women experiencing domestic violence. Anything?
Absolutely, yeah. We know that domestic violence does affect men as well. We see many male victims of abuse. I think, as the caller indicated, it is it's a difficult crime for anybody to come forward and disclose that they are experiencing, and I think even more so for men. But all of the services at Albion Fellows Bacon Center and the YWCA are available for male victims of domestic violence as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like Deb said, psychologically, it started out mainly verbal, you know, him lowering her self-esteem and constantly putting her down. I think a lot of times you see that's how it starts out, is the perpetrator or the suspect becomes comfortable with talking down to that person. And over a period of time, they develop this sense of security that they can go even further and further. And then, you know, they start putting their hands on them and so forth. And I actually have worked more cases this year so far than I thought I would work, as far as male victims coming forward. And I think that has a lot to do with promoting the awareness of it as well.
Hmm. Now, Matthew Elrod, so you've been detective for domestic violence for, I mean, just since January. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, I'm talking to you, you know, citizen Matthew Elrod, has this, I imagine, changed how you understand domestic violence, seeing these cases? You know, there, I'm sure you've been through hours of training, but once you've taken this role and actually seen and met victims and visited households, has there been kind of an evolution for you personally on the issue?
I have, like I said, learned a lot more heading forth as far as an investigative standpoint. As a deputy, you know, you make the initial run a lot of times, and you make the initial report, and you decide to make an arrest or not arrest, and then it gets assigned to the domestic violence investigator or detective. And, you know, they take a different approach. It's more personal with the victim. You have a lot more time that you can spend and learn about each one and kind of what they're going through, and you can kind of tailor what they need, you know, as far as victim services. You can actually spend a little bit more time and show them that, you know, there are multiple avenues that they can take for assistance, as opposed to, you know, when you're out on the scene as a deputy, you do have other things going on, and you don't have that luxury of spending as much time with a victim. Mm-hmm. So,
well, we are going to add another perspective to this conversation. The Wellborn Baptist Foundation estimates that there are about 20,000 Latinos, Hispanics living in the tri-state area. So my colleague Paula Marisan spoke with Carolina Sarasa, who has been reporting extensively on domestic abuse in the immigrant population, particularly with undocumented women.
In this period of time that, you know, you've been writing about it, and have you seen any change? Is there, have you, now that you're really involved in this subject, have you seen anything that has changed?
Unfortunately, no, I haven't seen any changes. I will see that the domestic violence statistics just keep on going up. If we wanted to, we could run a story of domestic violence every day. I think we need to do more, especially within the Latino community. We see this happening every day. We see all these women crossing the border undocumented, and they meet this man, and they feel that they can abuse him because they're not going to be able to go to the authorities and report these crimes. The truth is that they can go to the authorities, they can report these crimes, and sometimes if they qualify, they could even get a visa. It's called the U visa, because they were victims of these horrendous crimes. Unfortunately, I have not seen any changes, and I feel that we need to, I don't expect people to buy my book. I just expect people to at least, by hearing this conversation, they could at least say, you know, I know someone that is a victim of domestic violence. Let me just give him some information. Let me just Google domestic violence and find out if where I live they have any alternatives. They have all this free help, undocumented or not. They have so many resources, but people don't know about them.
And how often does this happen?
It happens every day. It happens every day. As I said, it's incredible. There's even a campaign called Every 9 Seconds. So every 9 seconds, a woman is a victim of domestic violence. Not only women, it also happens to men. It also happens to children. And it happens in all the scales of society. It happens to the rich ladies. It happens to the undocumented woman that just crossed the border. It happens to Debbie Flores Narvaez, the main character of my book, Dancing on Her Grave. She was a woman that she spoke three languages, Spanish, English, Portuguese. She had 3 degrees. She had a doctorate degree. She was an attorney. And of course she knew the law. Of course she knew that what her boyfriend was doing to her was not okay. But it happens to many of us that we fall in love with the wrong person. We always think, okay, I just met this guy. He's not what I think it is, but I'm going to make him change. I'm going to make him fall in love with me. And, well, he hit me once. Maybe he'll stop hitting me eventually. In this case, the police showed up to their home 14 occasions. More than 14 occasions they showed up because of different arguments they were having. At one point, the man, he broke the windshield of his car with her forehead. Another point, she was allegedly pregnant, and he hit her so bad that she lost the baby. People say that she should have known better. When we fall in love, sometimes we're blind, and we need that friend. We need that person that tells us, please, you need to put a stop to this. You need to save your life.
And now that you were talking about the Latino community, why is domestic abuse so prominent in the Latino community?
You know, it's sad to know that in our culture, I think that has changed. Little by little, we're seeing that men that have been raised in the United States, even if they are from the Latino culture, they are not as macho as before. We see that back in our countries, we see that we have been taught that we have to be married and stay married forever, regardless of what happens. We are taught that we have to respect our husbands. We are taught that we have to follow them. So I think a lot of women just stay married to this man because they feel that they have no other option. They feel that society is going to treat them different because they're divorced. they feel that they have no rights. So I think that's one of the reasons why statistics of domestic violence within the Latino community has been going up. And, of course, these people are migrating to the United States. The fortunate thing is that we see that now, as we are in the 2015, we see that little by little that has changed within the Latino community. We're understanding that there has to be equality, that we just don't have to follow a guy because he's our husband, and even if he abuses us, it's okay.
That was WNIN's Paola Marisan speaking with Carolina Sarasa. She is an author and three-time Emmy Award-winning journalist currently based in Los Angeles. She has a new book out called Dancing on Her Grave, The Murder of a Las Vegas Showgirl. It's now available on Amazon. And I'm Cass Harrington. Joining me in the studio, Leslie James, a crisis response advocate for the Albion Fellows Bacon Center, and Matthew Elrod. He's the domestic violence detective for the Vandenberg County Sheriff's Office. And we're taking your comments and questions on air. You can call 812-426-7400. Any questions you may have about domestic violence. So we just heard it from Carolina Sarraza, and I wanted to know, are you seeing more cases of domestic abuse reports in the undocumented population, or is it like Carolina said that, you know, perhaps they're too afraid to leave their situation because of their undocumented status? Leslie or Matthew?
I think, as we know, domestic violence is all about power and control. And so when we are working with a client who is undocumented, what better way to have power and control over that person than to threaten deportation, to threaten that nobody here in the United States understands our culture or will believe you that this is happening. And so I still, I think there's a lot of work to be done with mm-hmm. that community. And as we continue to see numbers of cases of domestic violence grow across all races, all backgrounds, all religions, all ages, we know, again, there's no discrimination there. But I think that there's still work to do to reach out to some of these underserved populations.
Matthew, I'm curious. So if you were to get a call of a report, someone saying, oh, you know, if someone in an apartment complex and they hear yelling next door and say it was in Spanish, and you say, and that caller says, I think there's a domestic violence case happening next door, and you or an officer or sheriff shows up, what would happen to the victim? Would Carolina said there are services available in the case the victim would be protected. Is that the case?
Yeah, you know, she would receive the same rights as any other person of ethnicity. That as far as getting victim services, you know, we're not going to say, oh, well, we don't have anybody for you. We're going to do the best that we can to meet her needs and get, you know, all the possible help that she needs, because, I mean, she's just as important to us as anybody else is. So,
but the fear of, you know, being deported, for example, is that legitimate?
No, I that's not something that, you know, we would look into. So,
okay. Well, we have a question or a comment from a caller, Yashu from Cincinnati, Ohio. You're on the air.
Hi. I was just wondering, as members of society, you know, you both are in positions of power where you can make a difference in the lives of those affected. But how can I, as a friend of someone who I may not know is undergoing this, how can I help them? What are some warning signs that everyday people need to look out for among their friends?
It's an excellent question. Thank you, Yashu. Who would like to take that?
I think it's a great question, and you know, we strive to keep a focus on developing what we call a community of advocates. And so just keeping this conversation going, talking about healthy relationships, keeping an eye out for any kinds of signs of power or control, somebody who seems unhappy in their relationship, somebody who is wearing clothing, for example, that is inconsistent with the season, or who isn't willing to talk about what's going on in their relationship. And so we encourage people, find a local agency, become a volunteer, become a community advocate, speak up about what's going on. This is an issue that is not just a women's issue. It's a community issue. It is a men's issue. We need more male advocates who are willing to join this conversation and take part in these kinds of discussions so that we can work towards elimination and prevention of domestic violence.
You said out of season clothing. Go ahead and illustrate that a little bit more.
Sure. So one of the things that we hear from a lot of our clients is, you know, that they'll wear scarves whenever it's 90 degrees outside, or long sleeves, or, you know, we've talked about domestic violence being all about power and control, and the person who's doing the abusing even controls where they're causing harm on the body. So physical injuries are often in places that are easily concealed by clothing or makeup. So turtlenecks to hide strangulation marks, long sleeves to hide fingerprint bruising, extra makeup to cover any kind of injury that may be on the face.
Well, Leslie, I want to talk a little bit about what Albion Fellows is doing. I know you provide housing for victims and their children. Often a lot of victims are children, and also social work and counseling. But over the years, have the needs changed, or is there a growing need in a certain area? Can you illustrate that for us?
Sure. So we do see a steady increase in the demand for our services, and we hope that can be attributed to the increase in awareness about the services that are available to those who are experiencing domestic and sexual violence. We do provide safe shelter to anyone who has experienced either domestic or sexual violence. We have counseling services available, both individual counseling as well as support group services. We have a team of staff members as well as trained volunteers who act as first responders. We are actually out in the community 24 hours a day, every day of the year, responding to people immediately post-crisis. So often those are taking place in hospital emergency rooms. But there's been recently kind of a shift also in the focus of our agency, where instead of keeping that focus on how are we going to eliminate that problem, we're looking at how do we prevent it from happening mm-hmm. in the first place. And so we have created a primary prevention program, and we're actually out in schools all across our 11-county service area, pretty much the entire southern region of the state, focusing on prevention. We're in schools, we're in universities, and we're talking to people about how do you identify healthy relationships? What does a healthy relationship look like? And how do you help someone if you suspect that they are in an abusive relationship?
Mm-hmm. Kind of a theme of this program has been ending that cycle, which is a big burden to carry. As we've mentioned today, it's a subject that has touched many of our lives. And it really begins with the youth. What can be done, and perhaps maybe even go a little bit further as what's being discussed in the schools, if a child, he or she, has seen their parents get physically abusive or have experienced abuse themselves, how can you intervene and explain to them that is not normal, or how can you change how they're interpreting that situation?
I think keeping a focus on being what we call upstanders, right, instead of being a bystander, instead of thinking what happens behind closed doors doesn't involve me, if we can have these communication, these conversations as families, as friends, in schools, in classrooms, to let people know that this is not normal, this is not what a healthy relationship looks like, and that it's okay to talk about it, and that there are agencies out there that provide help with no judgment and no expectation, but can provide some support and some services to help people figure out how to get to the ultimate goal, which is violence-free, healthy relationships.
Hmm. Yeah, and back to his question as far as what can a friend or family member do, I think from a law enforcement standpoint, I would encourage, you know, a lot of times a third-party witness, somebody that, you know, doesn't have any kind of play in their relationship, the, you know, victim and suspect, if you can get a statement from them and get them to come forward and, you know, be able to help law enforcement, you know, we're not just going to, if the victim doesn't come forward and make a claim or report, we're not just going to throw it away if, you know, a neighbor says, hey, this is what's going on over there. We're going to look into it and investigate it, you know, fully. And we're not just going to say, well, you know, you don't live in that household, so you didn't see or hear anything. So from that standpoint, you know, I would encourage people within the community, you know, go above and beyond. You know, if you see something happening, do your part. You know, call 911 and report the crime. You know, get what the person looks like. If he drives off in a car, you know, get a license plate, because a lot of times officers, you know, show up late to, you know, to the crime occurring, you know, they can't get there in the amount of time sometimes, and he gets away and flees the scene, and so we have an issue with catching him sometimes in the act. And I think it's important that the community realizes that if they step forward and help, you can eliminate it a lot easier than, because the victim, she or he needs all the help that they can get.
Mm-hmm.
So
I'm talking with Matthew Elrod. He's the domestic violence detective for the Vandenberg County Sheriff's Office. And Matthew, we talked about the challenges of this, how often, you know, these crimes are underreported because of that fear involved, because of the manipulation on the part of the abuser. Is there anything that the sheriff's office is doing to make it seem like a more approachable, or, you know, to encourage victims to go ahead and make that call? Because I, you know, that's a challenge for prosecutors, for bringing that abuser, that criminal, essentially, to light.
Yeah, you know, we try to work, we in partnership with Albion Fellows, Holly's House, Lampion, all these victim service groups, we try to work with them to do our part as far as helping promote and educate the awareness of domestic violence and getting people to come forward and report their crime, because like you said, there's such a great fear of, you know, what's going to happen to them if they report the crime. You know, they talk to the police officer, well, the police officer brings charges on him, and then he gets mad at me, and there we go, it starts it all over again, and so they get scared sometimes, and they might not want to pursue all the way with the prosecutor's office, and then things get dropped, and then she or he's right back at square one, having to go through the entire process all over again, because it is a lengthy process.
Has anything surprised you about this work?
Yeah, every day. I mean, you see things. That's what's unique about the position is, you know, you're never going to see something that's the exact same. Every case is totally different. And for that, you know, the circumstances of the case is constantly changing. It might be that they battered each other in front of their kids, but each kid is going to be different. Each family is going to be different. The complex of the home, I mean, everything is just, there's a lot that plays into it.
Mm-hmm. So. But sometimes you might see the same victim.
Yes. Actually, you do a lot of times where the victim ends up, you know, there is a conviction, but then the victim ends up going back and living with the perpetrator, and he does the same thing. And, you know, we bring charges again, you know, which enhances it to a felony, you know, at any time it occurs multiple times. And you do see that where the victim, you know, ends up saying, oh, well, you know, maybe he'll change, or things will change and I'll go back to him or her. I keep saying him. But, you know, the fact that it does happen repetitively and they get in that cycle, like we had talked about, the cycle of domestic violence, where it almost becomes a norm for them sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Well, and part of breaking that cycle is having these conversations publicly, openly, which is why I'm so thankful that you all were able to join us this afternoon. Any final thoughts or things that listeners can do going forward?
Really just, you know, like I said, for the community to step forward, call 911, call the sheriff's office, or, you know, if you're not comfortable with talking with law enforcement, call Albion Fellows, talk to them, and then they can talk with us. You know, there's multiple avenues that you can take. You don't always have to, if you're not fond of talking to police, at least talk to somebody, you know, get some help, you know, psychologically or physically.
So. Leslie?
And I would add that we have a great partnership here in Vandenberg County amongst law enforcement, the prosecutor's office, advocacy agencies. There are lots of different ways to help. We have two 24-hour crisis hotlines. People can call 812-422-5622, can confidentially get help. All of the services that are available at Albion are free of charge and always confidential.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us. We'll have more information about the guests and the programs mentioned on the trends page at WNIN.org. I've been speaking with Leslie James, a crisis response advocate for the Albion Fellows Bacon Center, and Matthew Elrod, detective covering domestic violence for the Vandenberg County Sheriff's Office. You've been listening to The Trend, a production of WNIN-FM Evansville, Henderson, and Owensboro. With your continued support, we're building a better tri-state together. Thanks for listening. Have a great afternoon.